Hello, dear listener. Before we jump in, I wanted to let you know that I know that many of you, if not most of you, are here for artists, gallerists, curators, writers, occasional collector, etc. Artist and art market generally related content. And V. Plumley is about as far from that world, from that model, as a guest on this show will ever be. But I want you to do yourself a favor and listen anyway, because it's an episode unlike any you will ever hear before or since, and you will be glad that you did. So thank you for sticking around, and now kick in the music. This is The Conversation. It's episode 157 with Fee Plumley. Way, way, way outside the norm of the Art World Center, but you're sticking around and I appreciate that. She is an Australian-based social activist, techno-evangelist, and nomad, among other things. She was recommended to me quite strongly by Ben Davis, former guest, who is the national critic for ArtNet News and an editor there. And so pretty good pedigree, I think. When he was down in Australia, Fee was one of the artists he met with and was very excited by. So I think you're going to be as well. And so stick around, and I'm glad you are. This is, like I said, who was that crazy guy, by the way, at the beginning? Very much outside of the mainstream art world. But that does not mean that there's not something very interesting for you to take in, being that she is traveling around Australia in her bus, Home James, her red bus with a white top. It's an amazing life, an amazing story, and I really look forward to you hearing it. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Home James, Fee Plumley in Home James, and Hammock Time, which is an interactive guided meditation in a hammock, organized event that Fee has done a few different places and will hopefully be doing in the States at some point soon. As I alluded to, this is a very non-traditional model, but there's a lot of really great stuff. I think you will really particularly appreciate her descriptions of from her five things I learned from living life as a solo bus-dwelling nomadic woman, among other things, you know, how she got into this, why she does it, and so on. And she is an artist. I think that's sort of the big question for you listening, like, why are we listening to this? Well, yes, she is an artist. It's a certain form of artist that is way outside the norm. And, you know, she has an uneasy relationship with that particular term, that moniker as well. And we talk about that briefly. So you'll hear all about that. I appreciate you being here. I want you to stick around on the back end to hear some more bad advice, which is becoming a regular outro feature, as well as some social media information that I think will be helpful to you. So thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. I hope you enjoy this, despite its being way outside the norm. I think you will. So stick around, and I will talk to you more on the back end. Thanks for being here. The question I always love to start off with, and it's could not be more appropriate with you down in Australia. Where are you exactly?
I am currently sat in the kitchen of a friend's house in the southeast of Adelaide.
Southeast of Adelaide. Okay, so is Adelaide kind to some extent sort of your home base, or not that you have one per se, but what if you would have one, what would it be?
Yeah, Adelaide's my kind of Australian home, my adopted Australian home. Yeah.
Right. Got it. And is your big red bus parked out in the driveway of your friend's house?
Not quite in the driveway, but just on the street opposite.
got it.
She's looking very dusty at the moment as well. I've been down in the limestone coast, so she very much looks like she's been road tripping.
right. Well, I guess, you know, if you've got a red bus and you're going to have, you know, sand on it, is that a pretty good match? I mean, in the right light, can it be camouflaged, or is it pretty obvious?
Well, I talk about ninja parking quite a lot, which right. is like pretending that I don't actually live in the bus. And right. Having a red bus with white roof, not terribly ninja.
Yeah, yeah. I left out the white roof, didn't I? Good point. Yeah, right. Well, for listeners, let's just sort of briefly establish that you are originally from UK, from Wales specifically, right? So why don't you just characterize kind of like to what extent now you feel like an Australian, or you feel like a person of the world, or, you know, what have you?
Ooh, blimey. Well, I used to say that I'm Welsh first, which is interesting because Wales is a principality, not a country. So
right.
being a principality-ist first, that sounds a bit weird. Well, I've been living in Australia for almost 9 years, and I've just submitted my citizenship application.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of love to be a citizen of the world. I think
right.
that would be a wonderful thing to be.
Right.
I have a very strange relationship to place in that I'm always fully wherever I am.
Mm.
And so wherever I am is always home.
Right.
Even if I'm backpacking or, you know, couch surfing or staying with friends or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just sort of.
Yeah.
I'm finding myself comfortable wherever I happen to end up, which is quite a nice thing.
That's a very Zen thing to, you know, use.
It's a very Zen thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of an easy cliche grab, but I mean, I think the sentiment, you know, holds that if you can be comfortable wherever you are, that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a real luxury.
Yeah. And where, by the way, since we're talking about place, you mentioned at the beginning of the call that you're in a few days going out of the country. Where are you going?
I'm going back to the UK. I'm going to go and be a responsible daughter for a while. My mum's not been doing so well, so it's time for me to go and put in some time helping her out, trying to get things settled with her, and also help out on a residency that I was helping with over here. It's an international partnership, so it's kind of a continuation of the work that they've been doing, and I'm just a sort of support role within that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have siblings that will be assisting you?
I have a big sister who lives down in Brighton, and she has constant pain, so she's not physically capable of doing the kind of work that may need to be done.
Right.
She's always there for moral support. And
right.
I honestly can't imagine what my life would be without my sister generally, not just with my mum.
Right. That's great. So getting back to Australia, where you've been for 9 years, right? So most of your life in the UK. But I was one of the things that, I mean, there are so many places that we can go in this conversation. One of them is, one of the things I came across in your writings was the state of the arts, you know, in Australia, which you wrote about. And so I guess my question around that sort of has to do with, so if you take Australia, the US, and the UK, right, as English, large English countries, are they basically, from your perspective, as far as the arts, all kind of on the same page as far as losing funding and, in favor of conservatism and capitalism?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're all kind of neoliberal centers of, within the arts, we'd say excellence. And I can't call neoliberalism excellent by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
So yeah, unfortunately, it's always the art that's from arts and humanities that are the first to go whenever there's austerity measures. And of course, those austerity measures don't affect banks or mining corporations
right.
or churches or, you know, non-taxpayers. They only affect the little people. So
right.
of course, the arts get slashed and it's very painful. But, you know, the positive side in some bizarre way is that you end up with very strong counterculture scenes in times like this.
Right. Yeah,
so I'm hoping that we're about to find a new world of punk will emerge
yeah.
from the crazy that's going on in the world.
Right. Well, that's by the way, you know, and neoliberalism is definitely a word that Ben Davis, who recommended you and was, you know, you were, I don't know if this is too objectivist a term, but, you know, you were kind of one of his big discoveries down and when he went down to Australia. Does that sound too objectifying?
It's just very funny.
Yeah. But he used that word neoliberalism a lot. And so all by way of saying that, I mean, you guys have a lot of
you know, crossover in your worldviews and whatnot, especially when it comes to the arts. But what I was also wanting to get to about Australia in that regard is, have you sort of settled there as opposed to, you know, another English-speaking country because there's more hope there in terms of the arts? Is it a more friendly place to somebody like you who is living a more punk slash nomadic lifestyle, or what would you say?
Well, when I first visited as an artist in 2003 and came back in 2004 and 2005, but I didn't move here until 2008. And my timing was quite bizarre. I moved my life over and then the global financial crisis hit. And so the UK started to go completely downhill. And so I was sort of watching from this pretty luxurious vantage point of a country that was investing more in its arts and certainly investing more in its technological environments and infrastructures. And then over the last 8-9 years, things have gotten progressively worse over here from that perspective, from the sort of funding and kind of core infrastructure perspective.
Right.
It's a very different climate in terms of the generic relationship to arts and culture and the funding establishments than America, because obviously you have the kind of patronage models.
Right.
And that very much affects people's relationships with art and their kind of ownership and their feeling that, it, you know, essentially patronage, I think, encourages more of that personal responsibility to support and engage with the arts, whereas a funding model might make it look like, well, or can often be skewed by mainstream media as being more of a, you know, artists are dolly bludgers and therefore they're the poor little people that you can choose to support if you want to, but nobody expects anything of it, you know? It's a very different culture. And then the UK, I'd say probably the UK and Australia are much more similar in their funding kind of strategies. The kind of top-down models are very similar.
Right.
Only Australia, of course, has less people and a much, much broader landmass, which encourages the tyranny of distance issue.
What is the tyranny of distance issue?
It's the fact that people are so far away from things that are happening in other spaces. So it's not just that it's difficult to, I mean, you know, any art event or, you know, cultural practice, it's difficult to find the resources, the money, the partnerships, the everything to be able to pull off a work, never mind get audiences to it. But when you're working in a land, in a country that has 24 million people,
right,
is the size of this continent,
right,
it's very, very difficult to bring audiences to your work if you're someone who works in regional and remote Australia. And so that just tends to perpetuate the myth that culture is made in the cities and toured out to the little people in the countryside, which is totally not how cultural practice works.
Right, I see. And is that model that you're describing, or that landscape that you're describing, make it the ideal place for your bus lifestyle?
Well, I've moved here before the bus sort of lifestyle became a thing. I mean, I've always loved the idea of living nomadically. And I've always, to a certain extent, been a nomad, but just not quite in this structured form. But it's certainly, I mean, Australia is the most amazing country to be a nomad in because of its ridiculously large geography.
Right.
And I think, I mean, you still get some of the same pressures of it's difficult to park up in a city. There are certain laws, like in Adelaide, it's illegal to sleep in your vehicle overnight, regardless of whether you're in a van or not. Traveller laws have been getting a lot more harsh. So it's, you know, it's difficult to maintain an existence which is outside of the norm in any country, I believe. But, you know, obviously it's a lot easier when you're in a white country that speaks English and you're white.
Right. So when you're in Adelaide, you're staying at your friend's and without any other option, right? Because your only option with your bus would be to go find some mobile home park and park it there, right?
No, I'm not a fan of caravan parks for a start. I mean, one of the reasons that I live in a bus is because I don't want to have to pay rent. I don't want the stress of an existence that forces me into that hamster wheel.
Right. The capitalist
so
hamster
if I'm
wheel.
Gonna pay, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm not a hamster. I don't need to be. I'll live in my own little box on wheels, but I'm not living in their boxes. That box doesn't make any sense at all. I'm not a huge fan of caravan sites. I tend, you know, if I've been traveling for weeks and I haven't had a hot shower and done any laundry for a while, I might pop into a campsite for a night and do a bit of maintenance.
Right.
But no, for the most part, I'll always find sneaky spots. And it's been 3.5 years now that I've been living in the bus, so I'm a great deal better at knowing what I'm looking for in terms of a safe and private park up that's not going to kind of create any grief with the neighbors as much as possible.
Right.
And I'm a lot more used to being moved on as well. So, you know, that kind of bang on the bus at 4 o'clock in the morning with someone going, "You can't sleep here."
Yeah, I'm going to have you, I don't know if you have your computer in front of you, but if you don't, that's fine. Cause I'd be happy to read it myself, but I think that passage is quite brilliant and we're going to have to revisit that, but in a little while.
Like the Five Things article.
Yep. Exactly. So what's a mobile home park in the States is a caravan park in Australia. Is it also a caravan park in the UK or is it something else?
They're probably more known as campsites.
Campsites.
Because generally it's tents preference to caravans or statics. But yeah, I mean, there's also trailer parks, right?
Sure.
Which tend to be a similar but different thing.
Right. I want to, for the listeners who are, and I know there's some out there, I don't know how many, but who want an ART angle on this. You did mention that when you came out to Australia originally, that you came as an artist. You're a techno-evangelist. You worked on mobile phones in terms of their artistic capacities quite early on, if not extremely early on. But how would you sort of describe maybe from the early days and maybe from the days where you would be most easily sort of identified from this kind of audience as an artist? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I've always struggled with the definition of artist. When I was little, my mum used to be an illustrator. My sister was highly involved in the arts. She used to play the violin she used to play the flute. Mm-hmm. And she was a photographer and a visual artist and a sculptor and ended up being a sculpture conservationist. And so, like, I've always considered that that's what other people did rather than that was what I was. And also, my mum told me when I was little that, you know, if you can do anything other than art, you probably should, because you'll never get anywhere. Like, you know, you'll never have any recognition. You'll never have any income. It's a hard life. And so, like, try and avoid being an artist if you could.
Your mother, can I just enter? Sorry, I was just going to say your mother is a very wise woman.
In some ways, yes.
Well, in that regard.
She definitely had a point, and it was a valid lesson, and you know, it did make me think about it, because I realized when it got to the point where I was like, well, I guess I'm stuck really, because I feel I have no choice but to work in the arts. It makes sense to me,
right,
even though I understand the risks of it. So it was good to know the risks before I kind of made that decision.
But you basically got into sort of interactive media and what have you, which was really the beginning of a boondoggle of a field in terms of potential jobs, right?
Well, theoretically, my interest with the technological side, because I'd worked in theatre as a sort of stage manager, prop maker, set designer for about 10 years, and like, you know, from being in school but still doing professional stuff. And then I dropped out of the theatre world because I just, the way, again, responding to funding. So the way that the funding system often works is that it will preference a particular art form or a particular sort of audience demographic or something like that. And so I was really interested in interactive kind of dynamic theatre that challenged you, theatre that kind of broadened your horizons rather than theatre that was a kind of repetition of a particular cultural norm from days gone by. So the sort of theatre that I used to love working with was things like Jozef Svoboda, and that idea of the scenography that moves in complete fusion with the sound and the physical movement and the text and the lighting and the, you know, it was kind of an immersive environment that would take you somewhere incredibly explosive in your own imagination, stimulated by whatever was happening on stage and audially.
Right.
And so I kind of found myself after several years just doing repetitions of Scrooge. And I just thought, this isn't what I got into theatre for. This is not exciting and challenging. And so I need to look for something else. And so I basically kind of stopped working in theatre, moved down to Brighton, and ended up moving into a house with a guy who had one of the first internet service provider accounts in like the early days of the internet coming to residential areas in the UK. So when was that? That was about 96. And of course, not, you know, early days in terms of the internet, but still early days in terms of the kind of the user base of
pretty early days of the internet. But pretty early days of the internet too.
Yeah, I guess. I always feel like I was a latecomer to it, but I guess, yeah.
In 96? No.
Well, I guess I know a lot of geeks who've been doing it for a great deal longer than that. So I kind of feel the shy, not clever enough geek around people like that.
Right. Okay.
But then I like to surround myself with people who I feel not clever enough around, because that means that they're amazing.
Right. Right. Just to get back to sort of circle back to the art sort of question, because you did describe the way you were describing the theater that you were doing, that sort of immersive theater. Definitely made me leap to, it sounds like, what some of the work you were doing with the technology, which was, you know, in some ways immersive. Do you feel like, to what extent do you feel like any of that work that you had have done in the past was, you know, an art? You know, like, I mean, you could have certainly applied it to art, as it often is these days, quite commonly. But say, you know, much further ago, you know, I don't know. It's not really important to me as far as the semantics of whether it's art or not, or the question of whether it's art or not. But just in terms of what you were doing, maybe translating to a visual artish audience at some point.
Yeah, well, we have this. Okay, let's try and think how to say this more accurately. I've been criticized a few times as not being what I do isn't art.
Right.
And so
who are the people that are criticizing you when you say that?
Generally people, like, this is going back a few years. Like, I've been working in media arts for 20 years.
Right.
And so going back to the early days, people would look at what we were doing with the Phone Book Limited and the kind of mobile art work, and they'd say, that's not art, because they saw it as more of the kind of industry content distribution rather than it being an arts practice.
Right,
trying to
avoid
the word practice for you.
Rather than
it being an arts experience.
Right,
so,
right.
Or a traditional considered arts experience. But then that comes back to the definition of the traditional arts experience being something which is a picture that hangs on a wall and it stays in a gallery and it has a product-based commercial value. And that's not the kind of work that I do, and that's not the kind of art that I personally choose to kind of surround myself with.
Sure.
So for me, the Phone Book was, I considered that we were not the artists in the sense that we didn't produce the content, but we were the artists in the sense that we created the platform and the creative challenge that then, you know, kind of worked to commission, to stimulate that content being created.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, we were artists, but to others, we were more creative producers.
Well, how would you, I mean, the way that I'm hearing your description of it, it sounds more like a form of engineer. Just maybe correct me if I'm misperceiving it.
Creative engineer. I like that. I might adopt that.
Feel free. but the engineer, I mean, if you're basically doing code to set up, to make these platforms possible, isn't that just, I mean, being an engineer as opposed to being an artist?
Yeah, I guess it is. But it's being an engineer with the view of the kind of the interest in dialogues which stimulate from that engineering rather than necessarily trying to just fix a problem or just design a new product.
Right.
It's more the act of exploration as a creative process.
One of the things that the immersive experience and, you know, and the platform building that we're describing reminded me of is one of the things that I talked about with Ben Davis at one point, which was, I think he was referring specifically to Pace Gallery, you know, which is one of the behemoth New York galleries, which has set up a gallery in Silicon Valley, which is where which has become a venue for these immersive, you know, sort of pseudo virtual reality type experiences, and how he thought that that was more of like a some kind of digital or virtual amusement park than art. And I wonder how that kind of perspective jives with you.
Well, I haven't seen that space and don't know anything about it, so I couldn't really comment directly on that. But the whole notion of art as entertainment complex is something that irks me deeply and has been for a very, very long time, which is actually why I loved Banksy's, I've forgotten what it's called now, the amazing theme park that he set up.
Describe, because I'm not sure I'm familiar with that.
Dismal Land. That's what it was called.
Dismal Land?
Dismal Land.
Dismal Land. Okay. And what was that? What was that
like?
As
in like it's miserable, dismal.
Right.
And yeah, it was in Weston-super-Mare. So it was in a an economically weak town in the south of England.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically set up this incredible, like, you know, it's like Disneyland, but it's just, it's very, very dark because it's Banksy.
Right.
And Banksy had commissioned a bunch of other artists as well. So it's his work and then a bunch of other artists' work, which, I mean, I didn't actually physically get there because I wasn't in the UK at the time, but it just looked like the most beautiful kind of comeback to the whole notion that art is entertainment and therefore should be treated as such, you know?
What was it, to shift gears to your arc as an artist and nomad and so on, what was it that you were working on specifically before that then led you to sort of drop out, as it were, and you know, become a nomad? If that, and you can correct me if I'm using, you know, sort of overly judgmental or derogatory terminology.
No, I quite like the dropout.
Good.
Language. It's something that's come up quite a few times in conversations over the years, and yeah, you know, in terms of societal norms, I've totally dropped out.
Right.
I'm not trying to build my career as an artist. I'm not trying to build personal wealth. I'm not trying to become part of the sort of hierarchy of the arts, technology, etc. world. I just want to live. I just want to be able to enjoy my connection to this beautiful country and to land and jet to the planet in general. I want to meet more people who live in diverse areas with diverse lives and diverse backgrounds, which, of course, you know, you can get a lot of diversity in cities, but you get to see a very different kind of existence when you travel around and see the world through the locality of different people's spaces.
Right.
And a similar applies with couch surfing, that, you know, when I did a lot of couch surfing in the run up to getting the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to see a very peculiar perspective on existence.
Sure.
Because you're essentially living in other people's lives.
Right.
And if you're open to that, then you get this perspective that other people don't see on a daily basis.
Right.
And so the nomadacy allows me to kind of insert myself into people's existences, but mm-hmm. still have my own space and my own independence and be able to take off when I need to. And, you know, it gives me the ultimate opportunity of access, but also the ultimate sense of independence and distance whenever you need it as well.
Right.
So it's the perfect blend for me.
I
always found that I would physically move from place to place to place and never quite feel settled. And so now I've just gone, well, fine, just live in from place to place to place, but be settled by having your own bus, carrying your shell on your back, essentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought I'd give that a go and see if that worked any better for me. And it turns out that, yes, it works remarkably well for me. I absolutely adore it.
It seems like from your description of that lifestyle choice and that lifestyle, my instinct right away is to say that sounds like a kind of a really selfless lifestyle in terms of its impact on the world. Do you think that's, I mean, but then if you look closer, you might find somewhere as well, I don't know, you know, you're still driving a bus and what have you. But I mean, but that is a fair way to describe it, wouldn't you say?
I hope, I have aspirations that it's that way, but mm-hmm. I think in reality, because I still require infrastructure. I still need fuel. I still need to drive on roads. I still need access to water, access to the internet, access to food.
Right.
I can't grow my own food because I don't have my own land on which to grow, or, you know, access to land to grow my own food. Although I do get a lot of food given to me while I travel around, which is rather fantastic. But yeah, you know, we still are very, very tied to our infrastructures. And unfortunately, as much as I would like to live an anarcho-syndicalist existence, but from a nomadic perspective, I'm still very aware that we are tied to these mainframe systems, and that's going to take a hell of a lot of coordination to balance, regardless of what happens in terms of world change.
Right. I mean, one of the really big sentences that you used in describing your dropping out was, you know, getting out of the hierarchy, essentially, in so many words, is what you said. And I wonder, and so I'm kind of trying to juggle, on one hand, what you're doing as a nomad, being sort of having an artistic life, or being an artist of the, you know, of the land, of the road, you know, of the world, in that sense, in that sort of very general kind of sense, that it's an artistic/artist lifestyle of the ultimate sort, you know. But then when you mention like getting out of the hierarchy, it's like, well, I'm not actually trying to strive as an artist, you know, in the traditional ways that artists do in big cities, you know. So in that sense, but it's kind of, whether you're intending to or not, you're maybe rewriting in your own small way that definition.
Well, I think I've actually come back round full circle to feeling more like a creative producer than an artist these days.
Sure.
I wanted to be an artist for a long time. And when I was told that I wasn't really an artist, I was more of a sort of administrator, facilitator, creative producer. That irked me quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up, the road trip itself, again, isn't really an artwork. It's a kind of process. It's a life rather than an art, you know? And obviously there's a lot of conversations and people are constantly telling me that my life is art. And I find that really quite unnerving. It's not something that I feel comfortable admitting myself, but it is something that comes up in conversation quite a lot.
Right.
But really, because everything in my world, you know, I also don't call myself a technologist, really. I'm a geek because I am interested in technology and knowledge and the process of realizing something creatively with technology and knowledge and audiences. But I think I'm really, everything in my world at the moment is about how can art and creative processes and technology contribute towards constructive social change. That's really where my whole focus is. And that has always been with me to some degree. I mean, I grew up in Thatcher's Britain, so I think I've always been an activist.
Right.
But bus life and that distance and that perspective that's come from bus life has definitely cemented this. Okay, what can I do to help? What can I do to be less of part of the problem? But what can I also do to actually help? And so everything is about what can the creative process and digital technologies, digital culture do to help drive social change.
Right. Beautiful. I'm sorry.
I'm kind of obsessive about it. It's a bit sad.
Yeah. Good. Well, you kind of have to be. Well, I think that's probably a good segue as any to visit a particular part of your travels. You did this piece back in the spring, Five Things I Learned from Living Life as a Solo Bus-Dwelling Nomadic Woman. And a couple of my favorites, or I should say, I think that the parts that I wanted to highlight are part three of the five, as well as the way that you conclude it. So, will you just please read Sexism to, let's see, where does it end? I'm directing you here. Welcome around this part. So I guess it's all a part three. So please, if you would.
So the whole of part three.
Yeah.
I'm actually in the process of getting myself together to try and write a book. So I think I need to get used to this reading sections of
right.
things that I've
written. Yeah. Well, don't rush is my only advice.
Cool. Okay. Sexism can sometimes work in your favor. I try to be respectful and park away from residences. Makeshift neighbors can be funny old protectionist beans. It's amazing that the number of times rangers or security get called to come and investigate the stranger parked on a public street. I've been woken in the early hours more than a few times by loud, aggressive banging on the outside of the bus. Not just a gentle rat-a-tat-tat at the front door, but a booming reminder echoing through your metal home that you are wrong. These bangs are always delivered in multiples, the community bodyguards encircling the bus, ensuring you are aware of their domination. When I, a bleary-eyed woman, open the door, that aggressive masculine stance more often than not rapidly falls away. You are not the bloke they were expecting, and they're not quite sure what to do about it all anymore. Their eyes say it all. They find themselves stuck between their paid role, which demands that they defend the self-imposed rights of the local rate-paying residents, and a deep-rooted instinct to help a woman in need. While patronizingly old-fashioned, this is helpful for me. I don't want to have to pack up and drive off before I've had a reasonable sleep. In fact, it's inappropriate for anyone, even a policeman, to ask you to drive when you're not properly rested. You could cause an accident. Run with that. Discuss the situation with them. You don't need to play any kind of nonsense, weak and feeble girly card or step up to match their aggression. Just be calm and rational and human. Politely but firmly explain your situation. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you couldn't park here. I'll leave first thing in the morning. And then both do so and don't go back there again. You're clearly not welcomed around those parts.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Yeah, I really wanted to revisit that because it conjured such a strong image, you know, of the booming on the door as, you know, at whatever 4 o'clock in the morning that somebody's banging on. So one question that comes to mind just on a practical level is, did it ever seem like it would make sense to put a note, you know, on the door saying woman sleeping or I'm sleeping, I'm, you know, I'm sorry if I'm disturbing you, I will leave first thing in the morning or anything like that? Or would that actually cause more trouble than it would be worth?
There's an old adage that it's easier to beg forgiveness than it is to ask for permission.
Right.
So yeah. If you're not actually doing anything wrong,
right.
And you know, you see no camping signs places, but you're not camping. You're not,
right.
You're not erecting a tent. You're not sticking stakes in the ground. You're right. Not burning a fire on the lawn. You know, you're not doing anything which is damaging that land in any particular way. In fact, very often nomads are the ones who are picking up the mess left behind by fishermen or by tourists or by locals. So, you know, we love to work in sync with the country rather than working against it and sort of extracting what we need and trashing the rest.
Right.
So no, it's I think if I was to put a note on the bus, it would essentially be setting me up to be the victim.
Right.
And I don't think I need to be a victim.
Right.
I don't think there's anything wrong in what I'm doing, and I have no shame in doing what I'm doing.
Sure.
Even though society suggests that I should be shameful,
be
ashamed
right.
of this.
Right.
I'm not.
Yeah. There are neighborhoods, I'm in a neighborhood, I should say, where there are a few streets and whatnot. Like there's this really wide street near where I am that sort of, it doesn't really end, but it's kind of abutment to a boulevard, you know? So, in other words, you go down to the end and you don't come to the end of the street, but it kind of curves around. And then that's sort of a side street to the main boulevard. And between the boulevard and that side street, there's a pathway, like a running pathway. And so people on that really wide street will park kind of near that pathway. And there are a couple of other streets as well, you know, that are somewhat, they're less sort of connected to the residences than in other neighborhoods, you know? So I guess all that to say that, you know, if you were to go into Brentwood in Los Angeles, for example, that would not be a very good place to try to park. And so I wonder if you both on a visual level as well as on a, you know, digital social media level, you know, have a sense of the kind of neighborhoods you're going into and the viability of being there.
Yeah, again, technology can be very, very useful, and nomadicy relies quite heavily on technology, or I find it does. So I use a few different apps. One of them is called Wikicamps, which, as the name would suggest, is a place where users can add new campsites. So, you know, very often that includes commercial campsites as well, but it's primarily designed for people to say, I parked up here and I had no problems. And that can be really useful, but also, you know, for a fact that if you found a beautiful, sneaky, quiet spot and no one's given you any grief, but you know that it's kind of borderline, you know that you're probably going to get moved on from there because it's a little bit too lovely and too easy. You know, especially if it's anywhere near a city, then yeah, there's a sort of tendency to not want to publicize those little spots. So you still keep places selfishly sometimes. But it's really useful to be able to just kind of go, okay, so I'm going to be somewhere around, I don't know, Mount Gambier. So I'll just have a look at Wikicamps and see what kind of spots are coming up as options. But then also using Google Maps and being able to actually scan the satellite images. So you can, you know, zoom in and actually have a look to see, is there a park up spot? How close to the road is it? Is there any kind of barrier between you and the road? Does it have a toilet? Does it have running water? You know, generally you don't expect, especially in Australia, you wouldn't expect to have water available, drinking water available from a layover spot. But, you know, sometimes there are rainwater tanks, and so sometimes you can get water. And also, like, Wikicamps is useful specifically because you can check things like, is there a mobile phone signal there? So that kind of information can really help you structure what you do. Because I'm a geek, I have to be online for the work that I do. And so I do spend large quantities of time offline, and increasingly am offline more than I used to be. But yeah, it's still necessary sometimes. Like, to do things like this, it's so expensive using mobile internet that if I don't know that I've got broadband access, it's difficult. It's expensive for me to do video call, you know, audio, like Skype calls.
Well, how does that get to be expensive?
Because I'm on mobile internet, and mobile internet in Australia is heinously expensive.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Like in the UK, if I've just reactivated my old British SIM. And so over there, I can spend £20 a month and have unlimited phone calls, unlimited text messages, and unlimited data. In this country, which is, you know, so £20 is like, I don't know, $40-something. Or wherever we are with the exchange rate at the moment. And I'm paying $45 a month, and I'm getting 6 gigabytes of data, which is not much at all when it's your only internet access.
What about Wi-Fi in Australia?
There's often, in some cities, there'll be public Wi-Fi, but you'll generally be restricted to how much you can upload or download. And generally the upload limits are lower than the download limits, which are even, you know, which are small anyway. So if you're a producer and you want to be uploading material, it's even harder for you to find places that you can do that.
If I
document an action, then I need to go and find a public internet access that isn't capped. We call it capped over here, so it's limited to how much you can download or upload. So yeah, I have to sort of go run around and do all the recording and then edit down little clips and then find myself an internet cafe somewhere that doesn't cap and then upload from there.
What are you uploading? What are we talking about?
Video footage from protests.
Oh, okay.
In some cases, yeah.
Well, one of the things that you and I only sort of briefly touched on when we spoke earlier is how you are monetizing your lifestyle, for lack of a better expression. Yeah, exactly. In quotes, right?
Not monetizing your lifestyle,
right. So I know you have Patreon, you know, which is a monthly funding support system, basically.
Which you are welcome to contribute to.
Listeners, yes. I would like to start a Patreon myself, so I don't know if we're going to be drinking from the same pool or what. But, I mean, you can be as frank or as vague as you care to be, but, I mean, how would you characterize your overhead? You know, are you, because I think the thing that touched this off is when you mentioned that for your work, you know, you need access. So one of your pieces of work is videoing the protests, but are you also doing any kind of tech consulting for a little bit of income from time to time?
I kind of am doing tech consulting, but I'm not really doing it for an income. I'm being a bit ridiculous at the moment. Things have kind of got a little bit out of hand on the old economics front. What I've been working towards is developing a set of tools and techniques and processes by which I can use creative technology to support social change for the grassroots community. Mm-hmm. So the project that I've just recently been working on, which is a campaign to stop a luxury golf course from being built on Aboriginal sacred middens, which is kind of shell remnants of where they used to live. Mm-hmm. And we know that there will be remains of Aboriginal ancestors in those areas. So mm-hmm. there's kind of the kind of spiritual sacredness of that land that we're trying to avoid. But it's also a very strong native plants, native habitats area with endangered and at-risk species living there. So from, you know, that particular campaign was me doing the call out to Aboriginal communities and saying, do you have a cause that you would like creative technology support with? And so I met this community and started working with them. And we've, you know, built this campaign, which has been a bit of a sort of pilot trial for me to put social, like grassroots organizing techniques into real life practice, mm-hmm. as opposed to working with other people on their campaigns. This is the first time that I've kind of directed a bit more of an expansion of an already existing campaign. Mm-hmm. But I have no interest in charging those people to help them do that, because grassroots communities are individuals, they're families, they're farmers, they're right. You know, they're everyday people. They don't have money to be able to pay you so right. that their cause can get more attention. And I also don't believe in the capitalist system. Right. So I don't want to charge people who are actually trying to make the world a better place. I think that that should be supported. That should be the world that we live in.
Right.
And so technically I'm I'm helping people, but and haven't found where that resourcing of myself comes from yet.
Right.
But that's something that I'm working on constantly.
Are you familiar with
where that pans out?
Are you familiar with the name Daniel Suello by any chance?
No.
He is a American who wrote the book called, or I'm sorry, he is the subject of a book about him called The Man Who Gave Up Money. So he's somebody who you may have heard about at some point, maybe in a more abstract way. But basically, he has been living in caves in Utah and staying with friends and so on, and you know, and working at co-ops, farms, etc. And has been for a good, I don't know, 15 years now, maybe living, you know, without money essentially. And so it sounds kind of like there are a lot of aspects to your life to a large extent that are like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easier to live without money if you completely remove yourself from society. Mm-hmm. And especially if you can find ways of foraging so that, you know, you don't need to be attached to the infrastructure of food networks and et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even that, if you want to forage and live off the land, the waterways are being poisoned by fracking.
Wow.
And so you can't even pick fresh water. You know, the chances are, the way things are moving at the moment, is that there are less and less places that you could just camp up and drink the local water from the stream. So, you know, and also there's less and less places where you could just camp up and live there. In Denmark, I think it is, that you can, there's a sort of common law that you can park up anywhere you like. And so essentially you can pitch a tent in someone's backyard if you want to, and they just have to accept that.
Wow.
And I think that's a far more logical way of doing things.
But not many people probably do that, though, I would imagine.
I'm honestly not sure. It's something that I really want to look into when I'm back over in Europe and just see if I can find some more information about it all. But it comes back to the old school commons model, which was, you know, you have access to doing anything you like with the land and the waterways, providing you don't cause anybody else any obstruction in having the same right.
Right.
So, you know, you can graze your sheep on this field.
Right.
But only if your sheep aren't eating all of the grass, so that other people can't graze their sheep on that field.
Mm.
And it's a much more respectful communal way to exist. You know, we're so greedy in our contemporary society. Yeah. We believe that each individual deserves to have absolutely everything. And it's horrific. It's horribly self-destructive.
Yeah.
And planet destructive.
Yeah, of course. So getting back to your lifestyle and you mentioned the foraging, you know, that one can do. Is foraging a regular part of your routine? To what extent is that the case?
I've been learning a bit more about bush tucker, but I'm certainly no expert in that regard.
What about dumpster diving?
Yeah, I was about to say I've been doing some dumpster diving.
Okay.
Not as much recently, when I was over in Perth, I was pretty much living off dumpster diving and collective community. In fact, I once found two trays of oysters was my most posh dumpster dive find ever.
Posh dumpster dive. That's awesome.
I know, right? I know. And I took them back to the squat where I was kind of hanging out partly with this mob up in Fremantle who have a squat up there, protesting against a new roadway being built in the center of town. So so we'd gone dumpster diving. I'd found these oysters, took them back. You know, you have to wash off all the packaging, make sure, you know, inspect everything to make sure that it's safe and not compromised in any way. And the rest of the guys were like, "You are kidding me. I'm not eating those. You're going to get horrible, horrible food poisoning."
Right.
And I was like, "No, the tray's still cold. They're wrapped in plastic.
Right.
There's no breaks on the plastic seal. I washed all the plastic off and I had a good look at everything, gave them a good sniff and they smelled totally fine.
Right.
And so I had a couple of them raw, but the other guy, they were just like, it's a dreadful idea. So I was like, okay, what if I cook them? And so I ended up doing Kirkpatrick oysters and only three of them would actually even try one of them. And they were convinced everybody was going to be super ill. But the next morning I had to go off really early in the morning and I didn't then go back to the squat for a while. And when I went back, they were all like, "Oh my God, we thought you died. We thought something horrible had happened." And I was like, "No, I was totally fine."
Right.
So yeah, you know, oysters come from skips as well. Much nicer when you pull them out of the ocean, but still.
Sure. The other things I want to talk about that you've done, and I don't know if you're still planning on doing it again, is hammock time. And this, I think this is important to bring up for a couple of reasons. One, in relation to what you were just talking about in terms of how, you know, greedy everybody is and what a destructive world it is and so on. And hammock time seems to be, it seems like your intention is to service the people that are addressing those problems, like social activists. But the other reason that I want to bring up is because you did it at Adelaide Fringe, right? So we can also look at the artistic / performance angle of it as well.
Well, yeah, the Fringe was a very specific kind of experience and wasn't the best for me personally.
Because?
For a number of reasons. One of them is that, I'm really, hammock time is an idea that I've been playing with for about 3-4 years.
Mm.
And the idea of it is that you give yourself permission to pause and reflect on the things that really matter in life.
Right.
You disconnect from your mobile phone. Like, we actively ask people to turn their phones off and give them to us so there's no distraction while they're in the hammock.
Right.
It's a total trick. Like, it's a con. I wanted people to really, because I was shown that I needed to slow down.
Right.
And subsequently I discovered hammocks and I was amazed that I hadn't actually spent ridiculous quantities of time in hammocks before that particular moment in time.
Mm.
And having found such a wonderfully restorative energy in them, I decided that, of course, you've got to help other people find access to that beautiful salvation as well. So yeah, hammock time has been something that I played around with in lots of different forms, including busking it at Fremantle Markets in WA and using it as a sort of installation piece within office blocks and different sorts of methods of delivering it. Mm-hmm. The first sort of serious public one was WOM Adelaide beginning of last year. And that was amazing because, you know, WOMAD is a world music festival. In Adelaide, it's something that happens within the Botanic Gardens, which mm-hmm. is a deeply beautiful, and if you're a cosmic hippie like me, a deeply spiritual place. Mm-hmm. So you're hanging a hammock in trees and you're mm-hmm. gazing up at these trees mm-hmm. and you're taking that 20 minutes to just give yourself complete relaxation, complete quiet time, complete reflection, complete mm-hmm. protection, because we, as your guide, sit next to you throughout your whole experience. Mm. We give you a short guided introduction, which kind of drops. It's not a body scan. It doesn't sort of dictate what you think about.
Right.
It just drops some ideas that you might want to think about, things about your breathing and things about your body. And we sit with you as your guide throughout your whole experience. We give you a short guided meditation based introduction that drops some ideas about the fact that you can focus on your breathing, the fact that you're thinking about your relationship with your body internally, you're recognizing that sound is a cacophony or it's a direct feed. You can choose to filter and remix the sort of ambient noises around you according to, you know, what's interesting, or you can just completely fade out all of that sound and just, you know, create your own silence. Because different people struggle with meditation. And so if you kind of say, this is a meditation exercise, you might find people would run away from it. But when you're creating a space which feels very safe and is, after all, basically you lying in a hammock, then why wouldn't you give that a go?
Right.
And so it's a very powerful thing. You really do see a transformation in the people who go through that as an exercise.
Do you feel like you and your fellow guides who led people, as it were, you know, in the hammock meditation needed to be in any way trained, you know, to be guides?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm, I took all of them. I showed them what the script was. But before anyone can be a guide, they have to be taken through the process.
Sure.
So they have to feel their own transformation so they can see what that's like, that's going to be like for other people. Because you're a caretaker in mm-hmm. that instance. Mm-hmm. You're in a very, very trusted situation. These are people who are, you know, your guests
right.
are essentially allowing themselves to be vulnerable in your presence.
Right.
And so that's a very privileged kind of vulnerability.
And of the people that you and your fellow guides you know, gave the meditation to, or however you want to put it, over the few years or, you know, several occasions that you've done it, how many would you say did kind of go down and become vulnerable and, you know, really experience it the way you hoped they would?
I'd say 99%.
Wow. That's fantastic record.
Because some people twitch, but when they come out, you talk to them about, you know, it's a very personal thing. So then they're under no obligation to tell us anything about where they went and what that did to them. We pose three social change questions at the beginning and then remind them at the end and ask for their answers at the end. And so that produces a kind of trigger point for conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But they're certainly under no obligation to do more than give us three one-word answers as a response to that question.
Right.
So sometimes people will have a very quiet experience and then they'll leave.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not quite sure, were they quiet and then they left because it just wasn't for them?
Mm-hmm.
Or were they quiet and then they left because it was just a very deeply personal internal experience?
Right.
And you never know. That's part of the beauty of this project, is that it's the death of the author. Like, I don't have the right to know what my
sure.
art did to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I'm always curious, but I think it's sure. lovely that I don't need to know.
You know, it feels like, and I'm sure this has occurred to you, but to me, it feels like it would be a perfect fit, to whatever degree it's feasible, that you would be touring around the country in your bus, and it would be sort of a never-ending tour of open house for hammock time, you know, wherever you go. And you would, you know, you would tweet out where you're going to be next and people would show up and, you know, you would do 10 sessions or whatever and you go on to the next place or something like that. Is that, was that a scenario that ever crossed your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in playing with it in different contexts. I do have a freestanding hammock. So essentially I can set up in a market or in a city street. Mm. I can also, I have hammock hooks in the bus. So I can actually run hammock time internally in the bus. Mm-hmm. But my preference is to hang hammocks in trees because I think the idea, the kind of the aesthetic of being held in a cocoon by nature mm-hmm. is very much part of that kind of reconnection to country, reconnection to yourself process. Mm-hmm. 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 But yeah, I mean, there's conversations at the moment about ways of taking hammock time as a model forward,
right,
which are quite interesting and I can't actually speak about at the moment. But yeah, definitely. I've always made, going back to that art question, I've always made large projects that are very process driven, very concept driven,
right,
and can often take several years to manifest. Mm-hmm. And so I very much want to create as an artist, even though my art isn't my kind of driving force at the moment. Mm-hmm. But as an artist, I'm really curious about creating a series of smaller pieces that can be used essentially, you know, the traveling minstrel of sort of interactive immersion, social change, art, mm-hmm. arts practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. To what extent do you feel? Do you feel proprietary over hammock time as far as like, what if I mentioned the idea to somebody, you know, in the States and they like said, oh, that sounds awesome, I'm going to do that. You know what I mean? Do you feel like that would be stealing or how do you see it in terms of existing elsewhere?
Interesting question, because as a general rule, I'm very much copy left. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do believe that you need, and I have fought very hard for my whole life about artists' rights. And mm-hmm. I'm, you know, a big proponent in educating artists about their rights and getting them to negotiate contracts and understand what intellectual property means as right. it relates to their work. So, you know, I'm very interested in remix culture and open source and open mm-hmm. knowledge and open culture. Mm-hmm. It would annoy me if somebody took hammock time and turned it into something more commercial, something less spiritual.
Right.
Because that, you know, that would just be, oh God, you took my lovely, beautiful, generous gift exchange idea right. and you turned it into yet another commodity.
Right. Well,
that would irk me.
Yeah. Let me interject
but
because
at the same time I'd be.
Sorry. I was just going to say, if you were to just to go back to my fantasy model, you know, where you're traveling around the country, you know, and wherever you're setting up shop, you're doing a day's worth or, you know, several sessions worth of hammock time. And that is funding, you know, your modest lifestyle. Do you feel like actually being paid enough to do that would be similar to being paid by the grassroots activists that you're helping out, that would be a conflict of interest of sorts?
Are you asking if earning any money is a conflict of interest?
No. Well, I guess, I mean, you use the, when you describe, you know, this fictional person sort of exploiting your hammock time as yet another commodity, I guess we have to sort of distinguish where is the line where it goes from being this totally sort of non-commercial spiritual entity to being a commodified entity. You know, where do you cross over that line?
Well, this is kind of what I looked into with the Adelaide Fringe version, because at WOMAD I was given a small commission fee and gave the experience away to the WOMAD audiences for free.
Mm-hmm.
And at Fringe I decided to explore the option of it as a standalone commercial entity, so I charged tickets.
Right.
It didn't work as well. There are a few issues around that, in that I wasn't in the best of mental health states, which is, you know, partly the reason that I produced that particular work, is because it helps my mental health
states, right,
and it helps other people's mental health states. I'm very interested in how art and culture can improve our existences on a number of levels. But yeah, it doesn't feel to me like hammock time is the kind of project that you should charge someone for, very much like you shouldn't charge grassroots, because, you know, it's not designed as something to make money. It's designed as something to improve people's quality of life.
Right. Are you able to lead yourself through a guided meditation, or do you need to really have it be properly executed? Do you need somebody, despite your experience, to lead you through a hammock time of your own?
I was thinking about this last night. I haven't actually done any meditation for a while. And last night, my head, because I'm leaving on Sunday, my head's all over the place. And so right. I was like, you should probably do some meditation. That would probably help.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do it on my own. I couldn't do it without a guided voice right. taking me through it.
Right.
And so that was actually quite interesting, that sometimes I can. Sometimes I can take myself through it without any problem.
Right.
And other times I'm just too distracted and I actually need someone else's voice to hang my progression onto.
Right.
So, yeah, it very much depends.
Maybe you can get your hosts to become guides before you go, and so they can give you at least one session.
Oh, they're all so incredibly generous. They want to make sure that I've had my hammock time. It's really quite beautiful.
Got it. Okay. Well, I thought, unless you had anything that you feel like we've left out, I thought we would kind of wind things down by revisiting your five things you learned and going to that last section. If you wouldn't mind reading again, the conclusion, starting with, so do I think it's safe?
Okie dokie.
Great.
So, do I think it's safe for women to travel solo? Of course I do. Sure, I've had rare moments where my definition of safety has been challenged, but I've had those when I lived in bricks and mortar too. Despite our otherness from mainstream society, we women are not the problem. The problem is a homogenous, patriarchal, enclosed system which tells women what we should and shouldn't do with our minds and bodies, and tells men it's okay to dominate, threaten, and rape women simply because she shouldn't have been there in the first place, never mind wearing those clothes. Some people are assholes, but for every single one of those douchebags, there are 30 more who are astonishing examples of the human race's generosity, curiosity, and otherness. When I was 8 years old, I would go tromping through the Welsh mountains accompanied only by my dog, a miniature wire-haired dachshund called Barney. When I was 13, I would roam the streets of London while my mum was in business meetings. I have always and will continue to unapologetically walk through unlit parks late at night. I don't own a gun, rape alarm, or any other form of device which some corporate marketing company tells me will make me feel safe. I just use my common sense and gut instinct. Bus life is not for every woman or every man, that's for sure. But it's the only life for me, regardless of what hangs from my chest or doesn't hang between my legs.
That's such a great ending. I have to say that it's a beautiful ending, but I do wonder why you would. Do you feel like it would be selling out to have a pepper spray or something like that? Just for emergencies?
I figure because it's my home, right next to the front door is my kitchen, and on a little shelf above the fridge is where my cutlery drawer exists, and I have a big cooking knife in there, mm-hmm. which I wouldn't want to use because, you know, the chances are they're going to be more experienced in using a knife than you are.
Right.
I think if you're going to be arming yourself in any way, and pepper spray is still an armed device, I think you need to be fully trained in using it and ideally better trained than the person who may be attacking you.
Right.
And I also think there's a certain... there's a certain assumed victim status in feeling that you can only be safe if you have a pepper spray.
Right.
You know, it's almost saying, well, of course this is going to happen at some point. Therefore, yeah. I'll buy this product that will make me feel safe. And I just don't, I'm 43 and I've been incredibly lucky. I've had some dodgy situations, but largely been very safe and got out of those dodgy situations. And I don't see why I should start feeling like a victim now.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, what you're describing is actually parallels directly the intelligent and informed description of gun use and ownership, you know, at least in this country, in which, in fact, if you do own guns, you are more likely to be a victim to them than if you don't own guns.
Well, yes. Guns don't kill people. People do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very, very scared for America. I think that you're in a very...
I guess I'm not
a very precarious time.
I guess I'm not going to be getting my hammock time anytime soon, at least in this country. Yeah.
Well, you never know. When I'm back in the UK, and my sister just sent me a link to a British Council program that's about art and social practice. Sorry, they use that word. I'm just quoting.
No, it's fine.
that's looking at an American-British partnership. So you can be a British arts social change person going to America to do a residency or vice versa.
Wow.
And so that's made me go, oh, that's interesting. I could like this, you know, what I've been doing for Care for Country has been this kind of test program to see if the model is going to work. Mm-hmm. And so now what I want to do is reinforce that model and make it more broadly available so that when I come back to Australia, I can go, hey, look, here's my package, who wants me?
Right.
But have a bit of sustainability underneath it. And so like there's a huge logic in spending time connecting with other social change groups who are also looking at arts and technology and how that brings change,
right?
To, you know, partner up with them. So you never know, I may be scheming coming over to America, and if I do, I'll bring a hammock.
Great. I can't wait. I really want to do hammock time, and I don't want to sell it out over here for you. So I'm just going to have to be patient. You know,
hammock time does, it's a very energy intensive project to give, because
right.
you're sharing that time with other people. You're in their presence.
Yeah.
And so it's quite exhausting to give, which is another reason that I won't commodify it, is
right.
because the reason it's exhausting is because it is such a unique personal gift exchange.
Yeah.
And you get a lot, you know, the reason I call it a gift exchange is that you, as a guide, when you have that dialogue with the people who've gone through that experience, it's incredibly enriching to see that transformation in them. And so you do get a recharge. But it's also, it's a very exhausting project. And so to sort of commit my life to only delivering that project would be a bit much.
Right. You know, I neglected to bring this up at the very beginning of our conversation. It was something I used to do in the podcast in the early days all the time. And I still do it occasionally. But your name, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about it. Fee Plumley is just, among other things, an incredibly onomatopoetic name.
Unpoetic.
No, yeah. Onomatopoetic. Poetic.
Oh, right.
Onomatopoetic,
okay.
Is what I meant. So is it in the name you were born with, first and last name?
The last name I was born with, the first name, I was actually born Fiona Elizabeth.
Okay.
And I changed it. Gosh, how old would I have been? Probably about 22 or something. I changed it to FEE. I figured I was already F.E. Plumley.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was little, I didn't like being called Fiona.
Mm-hmm.
No, wait. When I was little, I didn't like being called Fee. And then mm-hmm. when I grew up, I didn't like being called Fiona. And
mm-hmm.
so it was partly a kind of, okay, I'm going to solidify this. I don't want to be called Fiona thing. And so changed it to FEE instead of F.E.
Right, right.
But it's Dutch for fairy, which of course always begs the question, do you have Dutch relatives? And I don't at all. I just really like the name.
Hmm. But on the other hand, it's the most ironic first name for a nomad that one could have.
Well, as a creative producer, like, you know, I'd be having these conversations with people running conferences or festivals or somebody commissioning us somewhere in the world. And you'd be having this dialogue with them by email for ages. And they, you'd eventually meet them and they'd say, oh, I thought you were a bloke. Because
right.
it's such an androgynous name, and,
right.
and you know, the idea of being the producer and your name meaning money obviously meant that I was going to be male, which always used to make me giggle quite a lot.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm the anti-fee.
Yeah, you are. You're the anti-fee. Well, I am really appreciative, you know, even though you're doing it in the other quadrant of the world, of for what you're doing and, you know, the work that you're doing and to help heal the world. I'm happy that you're doing it, and it's great to talk to you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm merely contributing to a generic mass movement. I think we've hit the tipping point, actually. I think that there are now more people who are aware of the need for change and in support of change than are not right
now.
That's great. So I think we're at a really interesting point. And of course, things are going to get a lot worse before they get better.
Right.
But I'm utterly proud and also very scared, along with everybody else, about where we are going as a humanity. And I'm delighted to be part of a more constructive segment within it and helping wherever I can.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that's thanks great. For the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great talking with you. And we're out.
Thank you so much again to Fee Plumley for talking to me. And I hope life in the UK, probably in a stable home, is not making you too soft, Fee. So thanks so much again. I hope you guys got a lot out of that. I think those readings were particularly profound. And I hope you feel the same way as I do. Before we get to bad advice and some social media updates, I wanted to let you know that this is a listener-supported show, and it is very much appreciated when you support this show, ideally financially. You can do that by going to theconversationpod.com/support, where you can make a quick and easy PayPal donation. They're extremely appreciated. I love, love, love seeing those emails in a special compartment within my email inbox saying, you have received a donation. And I am fantastic about replying and showering with you with all kinds of thanks and offers and so on, including bonus footage, our bonus footage from the Max Maslansky episode, which we did not air with the main piece. So FYI. Of course, you can also follow the show on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and Facebook. Our handle is @artistpodcast. And speaking of social media, we would like to encourage you to make comments. It's a two-way street. You know, we have a social media team on every outlet standing by to interact with you. So do likes, do screenshots where appropriate. Make a good comment. And if it's a really good comment, we'll read it on the show. So how's that for a little enticement? And for Snapchat, if you are on Snapchat, we are now on Snapchat too. Anna's doing a great job of running that show. Do a couple of things if you're on Snapchat. Swipe up to comment if you're new to it, and do a screenshot to like and repost if you are so inspired. Okay, so that's the Snapchat call to action. I hope you take advantage of it in other social media. Now let's get on to our bad advice of the week. Okay, courtesy of Xandra Lassen. First one is, public art is passive aggressive, from the late Mike Kelly. No artist is ahead of his time. He is his time. It's just that others are behind the times. Martha Graham. And my favorite of the week, sex is like art. Most of it is pretty bad, and the good stuff is out of your price range. That's from Scott Roben. That's Roeben. I don't even know who he is, but it's a fantastic quote. Thank you very much for being here, for listening. Please do spread the word about Fee Plumley's episode if you are so inspired. I think it's pretty inspiring stuff. And let us know what you think. I know there are a couple of you out there going, this is not art. Why should I care? I can't believe I just listened to an hour and a half of this when I don't care about this stuff. Why are you making me listen to this? Well, I'm glad you opened up your mind. Just think of the results that will ensue within the coming weeks. So let us know what you thought, even if you are one of those folks. And thank you very much again. I will talk to you next week, where we'll have another mind-expanding guest. Ciao for now.